This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Thank you, George Floyd, for sacrificing your life for justice, for being there to call out to your mom. How heartbreaking was that? Call out for your mom. I can't breathe. But because of you, and because of thousands, millions of people around the world who came out for justice, your name will always be synonymous with justice.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back, everyone, and good afternoon. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew Mariani today and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. We've got a big show here for you today. We're going to have talk about Turkey and the Armenian genocide later in the show. We're going to be talking about policing issues in the next hour, as well as talking a little bit about North Dakota conscience laws and the Biden administration's decision to challenge a recent appellate court decision. And we'll be talking about that in the next half hour. But joining me right now to discuss the trial of Derek Chauvin and the implications of that trial is Andy McCarthy, a contributing editor at National Review, a senior fellow at the National Review Institute, and a Fox News contributor. He's a former chief assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of New York, and he led the terrorism prosecution against the blind sheikh. He is the author of Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. You can follow him on Twitter at Andrew C. McCarthy. Andy, welcome back. Great to talk to you again.
Ed, great to be with you.
You know, when this trial started, you know, I knew I wasn't going to be able to watch every minute of this trial, and I made a real conscious decision not to watch much of it at all. And the reason why is because I think that too often people who are attempting to comment on this thing do so in a way that sort of turns them into dilettantes. They dip in, they peek around, they dip back out, and they make broad judgments about things that unless you're fully immersed in a case as it's unfolding, you really can't necessarily comprehend. And so I was telling everybody, people said, well, you're not writing much about this. And I said, yeah, because I'm not watching the trial. I'm relying on guys who are watching the trial. I'm relying on guys like Scott Johnson at Powerline, Bill Jacobson over at Legal Insurrection, and Andy McCarthy at National Review. And I have to tell you, I thought that the legal analyses from all three of these sources were superb, not necessarily all in agreement, but I thought the analyses were superb. And first off, just want to give you kudos for the really good work that you did in helping your readers break that down, including me.
Well, I appreciate that, Ed. And I'm glad you said that because it made me feel good mostly, but I haven't, since I stopped doing my own trials, made a commitment to sort of strap in and watch a trial from beginning to end, which is something of a commitment in this case, because it could have gone even longer than it did. It went about to the jury selection. Scott, hats off to him for what he did.
Exactly.
But I think that when I was trying my own cases, I really didn't have time. You never have time when you're actually on trial to read media accounts of your trials. But to the extent I was familiar with them or stuff came to my attention, it's always inaccurate. And it's not always inaccurate, inaccurate in bad faith or because somebody has a spin. Usually, the media accounts don't know everything that you know as the litigant, and you really can't get a complete, as you just aptly pointed out, you can't really get an accurate assessment of exactly what's going on in the trial without actually watching the trial. So this was the first time I had done that in close to 20 years. And it really is it's a much different experience strapping in and almost being as if you were in the courtroom for the whole thing, as opposed to just getting it through media accounts.
I agree. And I think that the real value, I think, in having you, Scott, Bill, strap in and really spend every minute in the courtroom, even if it's virtually, obviously, because this was I think Minnesota's very first televised criminal trial, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe that's right.
Yeah. The value in that is that, you know, you have somebody who is a prosecutor or a litigator who, in your case, a prosecutor, who understands courtroom procedure, understands the nuances of what's going into the different exchanges and that sort of thing. And I think that the one thing that really did come through early and consistently in these analyses is that the defense case in the defense in this particular case wasn't nearly as strong as people may have presumed it to be, perhaps especially on the conservative side of the aisle, the people who were a little skeptical about bringing the charges in the first place. I think that people expected to see more of a, maybe less of a prosecution case and more of a defense case, and that was not the reality. All of you were writing about how strong the prosecution case actually was and how much the defense struggled to counter it.
Yeah, well, I think there's, I'd say there's two reasons for that. The first is the coverage lent itself to a kind of a false narrative about what the case was about, and that's specifically on the issue of causation. So if you were only to read the press coverage, what you would have thought was that either Floyd was killed by the police restraint and subdual out on the street in Minneapolis, or he died from his array of drug abuse and profound medical problems, which included, you know, enlarged heart, hypertension, blocked arteries. He had a lot of pretty serious conditions, and the amount of drugs, particularly fentanyl, that was in his system would have been enough to kill somebody who hadn't built up a tolerance over time due to abuse of opiates. So the way the case was kind of pitched to people, I think, Ed, was that it was one of these either-or situations, and it simply wasn't. The issue in the case was whether the prosecution could prove that the police restraint was a substantial cause of death. So it didn't have to be the only substantial cause, and it didn't have to be a situation where it didn't interact with other subsequent or intervening or even pre-causes. It simply had to be a substantial cause. So I think to the extent people thought that the defense was going to be in the game because they were going to be able to show that Floyd had all these profound problems, that never meant that the prosecutors would not be able to prove causation. And I really thought the case was closer on intent than causation. I thought causation was really not much of an issue after the beginning of the trial. And then I guess the second point I would make about it is I think it was a much closer case than the bottom line suggests. I mean, I as I've said, I would have convicted him on the manslaughter and acquitted him on the two murder counts. So, you know, the fact that the jury was it came back so fast and it was a sweeping series of convictions, I think belies the case, which was actually a closer case than that.
Do you think then that they were feeling pressure on this, or do you think that this is just a case of the prosecutors got themselves a good and sympathetic jury and were able to sort of make it compelling enough for them to follow along?
Yeah, well, I think both of those things could be true, right?
Right, right.
I think it's a separate question. You know, I am not arguing, I don't want to be misunderstood on this, I am
yep.
not arguing that the verdict was irrational. I think that the proof was close enough on intent. Like, for example, I'm sure I'm being influenced by this, but Chauvin was convicted of depraved indifference homicide. Now, part of my reason for poo-pooing that count, I'm sure, is that this really was not a depraved indifference case. Because classically, depraved indifference homicide is where somebody indiscriminately, say, shoots a gun into a crowd. You're not aiming at any particular person, but you're endangering everybody in the area. And it was controversial that there could be a count like that in this case. In fact, the judge didn't want it to let it in the case. It's only because of a divided opinion by the appellate court in Minnesota, which I think is wrong, that you have a depraved indifference count. So I think when I poo-poo that count, I'm thinking of my own idea of what that theory is versus Judge Cahill's instructions to the jury, which allowed them to find that what that the things that Chauvin did to Floyd exhibited depraved indifference to human life. So it wasn't an irrational verdict, and I come to it with a predisposition against it. But I don't see how it's possible that you find somebody has a depraved indifference to human life who actually called the ambulance to get the guy medical help when they could have, dragged him to the station house. It's not an intentional homicide count because they didn't have to find that Chauvin intended to kill Floyd. But the felony murder count, where you have to find that he intended to commit a criminal assault, I think reasonable minds can differ on that. I don't think he intended to significantly hurt Floyd. I think he intended to restrain him there. And to the extent that the medical testimony for the defense was relevant, I don't think it was. I think they made a mistake stressing it too much on causation, which they had no chance to win on. I think the relevance for the defense of the medical problems was that Chauvin could have argued that somebody from his perspective would have thought that a normal, healthy person would not have been put in any lethal danger by the amount of pressure that the police were putting on Floyd, and that he was a particularly vulnerable victim because of all these medical issues. And to see it as Chauvin might have seen it on the scene, he may not have thought he was putting Floyd in danger for his life. That would have been my argument. But I could easily see from the other side, the most damning thing in this case, Ed, is for 4 minutes, the prosecution kept talking about the 9 minutes and 29 seconds of this recording. The last 4 minutes, Floyd was not breathing and didn't have a pulse, and they continued to hold him down as right. if he was about to flee. And the pulmonologist who testified he was dead already, more than likely. So, you can easily see how the jury came out this way, but I just think it was a closer case.
We are speaking with Andy McCarthy from National Review, nationalreview.com. He's the author of Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. We're also taking your calls at 888-914-9149. If you have a question for us or want to join the conversation, 888-914-9149. Well, the trial is over now, Andy. And, of course, there's going to be appeals and there's going to be issues of whether or not Chauvin was able to get a fair trial. Obviously, that's something that every defense attorney is going to raise on appeal. And in this case, you even had Judge Cahill suggest that they might have an issue thanks to one member of Congress showing up in town while the jury was not yet sequestered and exhorting people to continue fighting in the streets if they didn't get the verdict they wanted. How often do these types of appeals work? And do you think that there's more of an issue here than there would be in most other trials?
They virtually never work, and there is more of an issue here. And with respect to Maxine Waters, who I think was rightly criticized by Judge Cahill, I think that would ordinarily, Ed, be the kind of thing that wouldn't even get you in the ballpark to get a case
right.
reversed if it was just in isolation. And I think there's a lot going on there. And I say this as somebody who thought that Judge Cahill did a good job mostly in the trial.
That was going to be actually my next question to you, is going to be assessing Judge Cahill's job. So thank you. You're way ahead of me as usual.
Well, it's relevant to the point you just made, because I think Cahill was transferring or transmitting or blaming Waters for a problem that's mostly of his own making, although not exclusively of his own making. In other words, the prejudice to Chauvin here and the doubt about whether he got due process is not really because of Maxine Waters. That's a part of it. But Chauvin maintained from the beginning that he could not get a trial, a fair trial in Hennepin County. And there was a lot of good reason to make that argument, beginning with the fact that the jury pool was in the middle of all this riotous activity over the summer. And all you need to do is walk around the vicinity of the courthouse to see how everything was tamped down. And look, Ed, they were not, everything was not boarded up because they were afraid that, you know, if Chauvin was convicted, that a bunch of people would come out and riot and protest, right? Everybody knew that the reason for that atmosphere was that there would be hell to pay if he were acquitted. When the judge was asked to move the case out of the county, he declined to do that, but said he would take care of it by doing an exacting jury selection process to ensure fairness. So then in the middle of the jury selection, the city of Minneapolis, which is the jurisdiction that's duty-bound, constitutionally bound to give this guy a fair trial, very publicly announces that they're paying the Floyd family a $27 million settlement, which obviously brands Chauvin as a killer. I mean, it couldn't be more emphatic. And then a week ago, when this awful accidental killing of Dante Wright happened in Brooklyn Center, the Chauvin defense implored the judge to sequester the jury because everybody knew what was going to be the fallout from all of that. And I don't think there was any good reason not to do it because they were at the very end of their presentation of evidence, and the jury was going to be sequestered once deliberation started anyway. So you're talking about maybe an extra day. You know, you end the evidence, you go right into summations, as most of us trial lawyers are used to doing, and then the judge charges the jury and they begin to deliberate. Instead, Judge Cahill sent them home for a long weekend. He gave everybody Friday off, and I think it's very interesting. He gave the parties Friday off because the evidence in the case was so complex. There was all of this technical medical testimony from, you know, pulmonologists and forensic pathologists and, you know, what have you. And there was voluminous testimony about police use of force and other procedures that were relevant to the case. So because the record was so big and complicated, he gave the lawyers an extra day to prepare. Now, that does two things. Number one, he sends the jury home for a long weekend knowing that there's going to be rioting and all the other stuff that went on in the vicinity, and knowing that the intense publicity was going to relate what happened in Brooklyn Center to Chauvin's case. And secondly, you have to ask yourself, if the case was so complex that the lawyers who've been living with it for however long they've been living with it needed an extra day to prepare their summations, how does the jury come in less than a day without giving the court a single note? Not one request for testimony, didn't ask to see an exhibit, didn't ask to get a clarification on the law, which is not exactly the most straightforward law in the history of criminal prosecutions. So I think when you put that record together, you have a pretty robust record to claim that Chauvin didn't get sufficient due process. Doesn't mean that the case is going to be reversed, and I think most appellate courts will look at this and say, even if this case was a model of due process, when you look at that tape, and especially that last 9.5 minutes, it's a powerful case, and it might not have made a difference. But I think he's in the ballpark more than the normal defendant would be, and I'm not saying that the jury was railroaded into convicting. But if Chauvin was ever going to have a chance to make a credible argument that the jury was overwhelmed by the prejudice, what had to happen is they had to decide the case quickly and in a way that was susceptible of an argument that they didn't really scrutinize the record.
And, of course, as you say, they did come back in pretty quickly. We got a couple of minutes left. I want to talk a little bit about the reaction now from the Department of Justice, which I found curious. I found the timing of this curious, which was the Department of Justice, Attorney General Merrick Garland, announced that the Department of Justice was going to look into the policing practices in the city of Minneapolis. Now, Merrick Garland has been Attorney General for at least 2 months. I forget exactly when his confirmation date was. This is not a new issue. I know why William Barr and Donald Trump weren't interested in doing this, because they are more or less ideologically opposed to the type of consent decree control, federal control of local police departments. But I mean, it's been at least 5 or 6 weeks that Merrick Garland has been in office. And I found it interesting that they decided to announce that now, even though there's still another trial left to go. I mean, do you find that to be a curious thing? And is that going to be a problem for the next trial that's coming up with the other three officers?
Well, I find it to be a very political thing. I don't know how much it'll infect the trial of the other three officers, but let me say this, Ed. Having watched the trial, there is not a shred of evidence, not a scintilla of evidence in the record that Chauvin was motivated by racism. One of the officers who responded and actually was involved in a scuffle with Floyd before Chauvin ever showed up on the scene was an African American. The chief of the police who testified at the trial, Madaria Arredondo, is an African American who's a police reform guy, right?
Right.
The jury, there's no evidence, you know, it's commonly thought that Chauvin choked Floyd to death. The emphatic testimony in the trial was there was no choking. Now, I think if you ask 9 out of 10 people who think they know anything about this case, everybody thinks Floyd was choked to death. He was not choked. Didn't happen. So there's a lot of misinformation about the case, but there's no indicia. You know, I mean, they're about to try to pass some legislation in Congress that's based on the premise that there's systemic racism, and this case is indicative of that, and they want to ban chokehold. There's no racism in the case, and there was no choking in the case.
Right.
So I think this is all very political, and there's obviously a lot more to it than just Minneapolis. I think what you have here is the left wants to take this progressive prosecutor project that they're running in a number of big cities in this country, which is why we have spiking crime in those cities, and they want to nationalize it. And the easiest way to do that is to have the Justice Department do these pattern and practice investigations, where they basically extort the local municipality into signing a consent decree and federal monitoring. And, you know, the next thing you have federalized police across the country.
Exactly. Andy McCarthy, nationalreview.com. He's on Twitter at Andrew C. McCarthy. Thank you so much for being with us. Coming up next is Joe Davis from Beckett Law. We're going to talk a little bit about conscience protections in North Dakota and elsewhere. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew, and we'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show is here for you right here. It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Let's turn our attention to the Biden administration and its obvious change of direction in terms of dealing with Obamacare mandates and the requirements that are being imposed on providers to perform certain functions that might cross their religious sensibilities. There was a lot of progress in fighting back against this over the last 4 years, in large part, of course, because there was a friendly administration that wasn't imposing these mandates and rolling them back where they existed. But now, of course, elections have consequences, and the new administration is picking up where the administration previous to that had left off. Joining us to discuss one of these cases is Joe Davis. He's legal counsel at Beckett Law. His work there has included appellate litigation in both federal and state courts, including representing government entities sued because of their openness to religious expression, and working on cases involving Native American use of sacred sites and discrimination against religious entities and government programs. Joe has been featured in radio interviews with USA Radio Network, right here on Relevant Radio, American Family News, and others, and he's been often quoted in in print media outlets. Joe, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Well, let's talk. I mean, this is a case that's sort of flown a little under my radar. So, I mean, I'm kind of just catching up to this case. This was a case that took place in North Dakota. A federal court struck down a mandate that required providers and most insurers, and I'm going to say underscore most insurers because there's a really interesting exception to this, to perform and fund transgender surgeries, transgender therapies, even when the providers themselves had religious objections to this. And a federal court ruled in 3 months ago, in January, I believe, that that was unconstitutional and the government could not do that. And of course, you guys at Beckett Law were hoping that that was where it was going to sit, but of course, you knew it wasn't. And I'm sure that you were prepared for the eventual decision of the Biden administration to appeal that case. So tell us a little bit about the case and tell us a little bit about what the stakes are involved here.
Yeah, sure. So as you said, this is a case about an effort by first the Obama administration and then, of course, later administrations to force religious healthcare providers to perform gender transition procedures, even if those procedures violate their religious beliefs and even if those procedures violate their best medical judgment, their medical expertise. So what the government did is they interpreted the Affordable Care Act, which bans sex discrimination. They interpreted that to include gender identity discrimination. And then they said that that means that it's unlawful discrimination for a doctor to say perform certain procedures for non-gender transition purposes if they won't also perform those procedures for a gender transition. So, you know, for example, doctors would have to be willing to remove healthy tissue for purposes of sex reassignment procedure if they would, you know, remove cancerous tissue for purposes of a procedure to treat that disease. So this was really an extreme move by the government, and it's something that we've been fighting, representing Catholic healthcare providers in North Dakota. And as you said, a couple of months ago, we got a great ruling from a court saying that the government's actions were illegal. You can't do that under federal civil rights law. You have to protect and respect doctors' medical conscience and medical judgment on these issues. And then just this week, the administration has appealed that ruling, and so we're going up to the Court of Appeals.
So, you know, it's interesting, though, who's being mandated to do this and who isn't. I mean, there's a website here that you can go to learn a little bit more about this. Of course, you can go to beckettlaw.org because the case is right there. And this is Sisters of Mercy v. Becerra. And it was, again, originally decided in the District Court of North Dakota. It's going to the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals right now because of the Biden administration's filing of an appeal. But you can also go to transgendermandate.org to learn a little bit more about this case and the larger issues involved. But one of the larger issues involved is who's required to follow this mandate. And at least according to transgendermandate.org, there are two... there are two plans that are not required to fund this. One is called Medicare and the other is called Medicaid. Joe, how does the government get around that?
Yeah, it's a great point. It's really the government trying to impose on others, including religious objectors, a mandate that it doesn't even impose on itself, which is really just an extreme and illogical thing to do. But as you said, you know, even this was the Obama administration. The Obama administration, Medicare and Medicaid agencies, their expert doctors said, we're not going to require this to be provided across the board because sort of the jury is still out on the science. There's lots of studies that show that there are significant harms from these procedures. And the studies that that show their benefits are not very good, not very robust. There's really just not a good case that there are any benefits from these procedures, and there are obvious risks. And so that's what the administration's own doctors said with respect to Medicare and Medicaid, and yet they turned around and tried to force the rest of the country, including private religious objectors, to perform the procedures.
So this isn't even anything that they're trying to apply universally. I mean, I think it's certainly very curious that they see room for exceptions for the government-administered plans here, but not for plans and providers that are involving people of religious faith that object to these types of procedures. And it's not as though there aren't other providers, right? I mean, we were sort of back in the same bake me the cake sort of paradigm here, right? I mean, there are other providers here who probably are willing and able to provide these services. So it's odd that the government would take the position that that providers are mandated to provide this type of coverage. Now, perhaps there is I would call it a bandwidth issue, but a market issue in North Dakota for this. I'm not sure what the specific issue is here, but certainly it shouldn't fall to the Sisters of Mercy to do this type of work.
I think that's right. If you want to force people to perform these kinds of procedures, that just seems like a very odd way to increase access to them, because these are people that don't have expertise to perform these kind of procedures, and they object to it because of the Hippocratic Oath, because of their religious beliefs. So these would seem like the last people that the government would want to force to be involved in this kind of stuff, especially when there are, as you said, there are plenty of willing and able providers. It's been a growing field of medicine, for better or for worse. So the notion that the government needs to enlist, an order of nuns in North Dakota to perform these procedures just kind of begs belief.
It is very strange. We're talking with Joe Davis. We're taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149, talking about this case, and BeckettLaw.org, of course. And you can find out, again, more about this case at BeckettLaw.org. That's where I'm getting my information, as well as at TransgenderMandate.org. This is, first off, I guess I could ask you, what was the decision by the Federal Circuit Court? What specifically did they rule in this case? I'm sure that the judge wrote an opinion on this. I'm sure that the opinion had some bearing as to, what the justification was for this particular decision.
Sure. The judge wrote a very good opinion, a very strong opinion, protecting religious freedom in this case. It was under a statute called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is a law that provides that religious objectors can get exceptions from rules if the government can't show a really, really compelling reason that it needs to apply a rule to the particular religious objector. And so what the court said was, this is a significant burden on religious healthcare providers. The government is telling them that they either have to perform these procedures that violate their medical judgment, that violate their religious beliefs, or they effectively have to get out of the business of get out of the profession of performing medicine. So the court said that's a significant burden, and it has to have a really strong justification. So we looked over on the justification side, and it didn't find a really strong justification for some of the reasons that we've already talked about.
Right.
There's no reason that the government has to enlist religious objectors to perform these procedures when there are other people that seem ready, willing, and able to do it. And I think most importantly, there's the medical data is just out on this. It makes no sense for the government to be mandating procedures that that the medical literature doesn't even show have a clear benefit, and they do show have clear risks and harms.
And this is not the first court that's ruled on this. This was something that had been decided a few years prior to this, too, right, in terms of this exact same mandate, in North Dakota, in fact.
That's right. There are actually multiple cases challenging the same mandate. There's the case in North Dakota that we've been talking about. There's another case down in Texas, also involving a Catholic healthcare system and then a large association of Christian healthcare providers. And both courts have come out the same way on this. The government has lost twice at the district court level, and yet they're seeking to appeal here. And so, we're looking forward to arguing that they should lose again, and that's what we expect to happen.
The decision, by the way, in the most recent case, which is the one in North Dakota, the one that we've been talking about, was at the time called Sisters of Mercy versus Azar, because Alex Azar, of course, was HHS secretary at that particular point in time. Was this something that the Trump administration was also pushing? I was under the impression that they were more or less trying to roll back these cases, or were they just kind of stuck with this case and couldn't find a way out of it for during the interceding 4 years?
So there was some movement by the last administration to issue a different rule, a rule that was sort of it seemed on its face to be trying to roll back the mandate, but it didn't actually go all the way. And then that new rule by the last administration was actually transgender activists and others sued over that rule and got it enjoined before it ever really took effect. And then that's when the change in administrations happened from the last administration to this one. So, you know, it's a story of where the case just sort of hung around long enough for other administration. Well, the problem never really went away. And now the administration now is really amplifying it and trying to take it to a different level with the appeal.
Right. And, you know, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say one administration is all sweetness and light and the other is all, you know, darkness and gloom. Administrations come, administrations go. But that's the reason why you have the enduring rule of law and the Constitution, which is supposed to protect the principle of religious expression. And religious expression, Joe, doesn't mean you can go into a church, synagogue, or temple or mosque, and then when you come out, you have to put it all aside. I mean, religious expression is being able to live your life in the full expression of your faith. And these mandates, sometimes it doesn't really matter which administration is creating these mandates. These mandates and the increasing role of government in what used to be personal choices is what really creates this encroachment on religious expression and religious freedom. And I mean, this is one of the reasons why BeckettLaw.org is very busy dealing with the implications of these. Of these bills, of these laws that promise to do very comprehensive things and end up stepping on a lot of constitutional toes.
I think that's right. This shouldn't be a political issue. It shouldn't be a partisan issue.
The
statute that we're talking that's protecting the Religious Sisters of Mercy here is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which at the time was passed with overwhelming majorities in both houses of Congress from both parties. Religious freedom is something we should all be able to agree on, and it's unfortunate to see this appeal in this case, which, the only reason that the government would appeal is if they wanted to specifically go after the religious objectors, because, the only result of the lower court decision here was to give an exemption.
And where are these? I mean, we've got a couple minutes left, and I want to get to how people can help out with this case. But really quickly, where does this appeal leave these providers? Right now, they're not having to comply with anything, right? That part is at least enjoined for right now. Or am I mistaken about that?
No, that's correct. There's the strong opinion from the lower court that enjoins the government from applying this rule to the Religious Sisters of Mercy and the other plaintiffs in the case, and so the next move is to go to the Court of Appeals and hear what they have to say. And we're very confident in our arguments, and we think we're in a strong position.
And of course, you can find out more about this, as I've been saying, at BeckettLaw.org, which is a great website. They're covering all sorts of different cases, and I'm sure that Joe is involved in many of these things. But how else can people help out in supporting your work in these cases? I mean, Beckett Law is really doing this on behalf of providers and people of faith, and this is an audience, I think, that would be very interested in finding out how they can help within that mission.
Yeah, sure. The Beckett Fund, we're a nonprofit law firm. We represent people of all faiths, from A to Z, Anglicans and Zoroastrians, as we like to say. And as you said, you can keep up with our work at BeckettLaw.org. We have a Twitter account, @BeckettLaw. And those are really the best places to see what we're up to. But we have a lot of interesting cases right now and a lot of very important cases protecting religious freedom.
Joe Davis, thank you so much for being with us. Joe Davis, of course, from BeckettLaw.org. You should go there to check that out. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
It's 51 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of hotair.com, filling in for Drew Mariani today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. We're going to have the Chaplain of Divine Mercy at the top of the hour, so be sure to stick around for that. We've got a great show still to come. We're going to be talking about policing issues after the Chaplain. We're going to be pretty much doing that the entire second hour. And then after that, we're going to have King Banyan on from KYCR Radio here in the Twin Cities to talk a little bit about the Armenian genocide, the apparent decision, by the Biden administration to follow through on promises made by presidents of both parties for really decades and have a formal recognition that of the Armenian genocide and what that means in terms of our Middle East policy, what that means in terms of our partnership with Turkey and NATO, and for that matter, our Air Force base at Incirlik. So there's a lot that goes into that. King is somebody who has done a lot of work in the Caucasus and knows this issue very deeply. And as you will find out in the third hour, he feels about it very deeply as well. And we're going to talk to him a little bit about that. It's going to be a great show, so be sure to stick around. You know, there was something in the ad that we just heard with Father Simon. Other than the I read the last page, We Win, which I love. I love hearing that clip. It's a great clip. But he talks about confession, and we'll talk about this for maybe just a few minutes. And if you've got a something that you want to say about the Sacrament of Reconciliation or your experience with it, especially in COVID, you know, feel free to call in 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. And I went to confession over the weekend for the reason I usually go to confession. My wife made me go, and so and she's listening in the other room, so she's probably rolling her eyes and deeply sighing at this. But I mean, this is, you know, this is why you get married, right? It's one of the reasons why you get married, is because this marriage is the model of the Trinitarian life. It's our way of training ourselves for the Trinitarian life, and sometimes that means that you hold yourself accountable, and sometimes it means that your spouse holds you accountable, and you hold your spouse accountable. And it had actually been a while then since we had a chance to do this. It's been difficult in the pandemic, and I would imagine that many Relevant Radio listeners have experienced this. Maybe many are still experiencing this, because it's been difficult to go into churches for the past year. Now that we're all getting vaccinated, and of course my wife and I are actually vaccinated, we're well past our doses now, so we should feel very confident in going into places. We were able to do confession this time around, and the previous experience we had with that was actually a parking lot confession, which was kind of fun, actually. We all got together in a line and we drove around the parking lot, and then, you know, one car would go out where Father was at, and they do that. And it was not a warm, pleasant day. It was actually a really chilly day, and God bless our priests for being out there and doing that. But it's been difficult to get to confession, and it's been difficult to the point where once you do go to confession, you feel very much like, oh my goodness, I've had all these thoughts during our confinement here, and a lot of them weren't helpful, and there's other things going on, and I haven't been my best self. And I always have a little trepidation going to confession. I always do. And I'm sure most people do. But I mean, I am always thinking, man, do I really want to say this out loud? And you forget how good it feels to actually unload this, especially when you have a confessor who is kind and understanding and who is encouraging, as many of our priests are. And we're fortunate to have one here locally who just is a beautiful confessor. And so it makes it easier for us, but it doesn't necessarily make it easy. And again, if you want to contribute, if you want to comment on this, feel free to give us a call at 888-914-9149. But I'm just sort of relating, I think, something that really is about connection, right? I mean, confession is really about connection. And we forget this because we tend to think, I tend to think, that confession is all about, oh, these are all the things I did wrong. These are all the ways I've failed. I've failed you. Let me give you, you know, A to Z. I can give it to you alphabetically, chronologically, or in order of importance. These are all the ways I've failed. And that's how you feel going into confession. But when you come out, if you've had a really good experience with this, I think what you feel is connection. That's the reason why we call it the Sacrament of Reconciliation. And again, you know, most of us already know this intellectually. I certainly know this intellectually. It's different, though, knowing it emotionally and feeling the confidence of that. And the longer you're away from it, the more difficult it is to remember that this is about reconnection. It's reconnection to God, but it's also reconnection to yourself. It's a reconnection to your true self, or at least as close as you can get to your true self as God wants you to be. And in that moment of absolution, if you are serious about this, you come out of that thinking, yeah, I've really failed, but now I kind of see myself again the way that I want God to see me and the way I hope God sees me. And these are the types of things that I think were really the damage done in the pandemic and the isolation. As necessary as some of this might have been, and we can debate forever probably how much of it was necessary, how much of it was not. This is the type of thing that I think is, it's not just a physical health issue. It's not just a mental health issue. It's a spiritual health issue. And, you know, we've been relying on Relevant Radio for going to masses, you know, during this period of time, and it's been wonderful having that. But all of these things tend to create this loss of connection. And I am continually surprised, I guess, and I shouldn't be, but I am continually surprised by the connection that is provided during that reconciliation, during that confession, even when you are at your, especially because you're at your most abject humility in terms of recognizing who you are and what you've done. And in terms of recognizing that what you did was sinful, which is sometimes a difficult admission to come up with in the first place, you're really just restoring that relationship. You're reconnecting. You're reconciling, but you're reconciling not just with God, but you're reconciling with yourself. And in doing so, you're also reconciling with the people who are around you. You see everything differently. You see it again as part of that Trinitarian life. Maybe just a glimpse of it, right? Because we're still imperfect. We haven't been perfected. We're still struggling. We're still going to struggle with sin. But in that moment, you can see hope. You can see the hope, and that's what reconciles us. That's what reconnects us. Coming up next, the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.